This is Stateside for Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. The state of Michigan is increasing the amount of money you can have and still qualify for benefits.
It's $15,000 now that people can have up to for assets in the bank to get food assistance, cash assistance, and emergency assistance.
The legislature passed bills that would stop the state from automatically treating 17-year-olds as adults in the criminal justice system.
Every other system or institution that serves young people treats 17-year-olds as kids.
Money for Pure Michigan was eliminated from the state budget by a line item veto. We look at that and also why Pure Michigan is so popular.
It invokes emotion. And when you look at tourism marketing, that's really what it's all about.
Then a butterfly that was abundant in the 1990s is now nearly wiped out. Habitat has been reduced, but there is another suspect.
Pesticides and herbicides. And that's what we think is the big cause of recent decline.
All of that and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Today, the Powashik skipperling butterfly is Michigan's most endangered species.
We know one thing that's happened. Its habitat has been lost. But even then, it's declined still further.
Later in the program, we'll talk about what happened and if the butterfly can be saved from extinction. But first, the Whitmer administration is making it easier for some people to get assistance for food, heating bills, and so on. Emily Lawler with MLive has been reporting on this. Hi there.
Hey.
What's changed?
So there were three different asset limits, and assets are referring mainly to the cash that people can have, but also, previously to this policy, some restrictions on vehicles and other valuable assets like that as well. And the three limits have become one, and it's $15,000 now that people can have up to for assets in the bank to get food assistance, cash assistance, and emergency assistance through the State Department of Health and Human Services.
I realize there are three different levels, but how does that differ, the $15,000 now and what we had before?
Yep. So for emergency assistance, it was $500. And then $3,000 for cash, I think, and $5,000 for food, or I might be mixing cash and food up. But they were all at different levels before. And this kind of brings them all to the same level and then also loosens some requirements that the DHHS was saying took a lot of staff time to verify the amounts in everyone's accounts, essentially, so that they could get connected with these assistance programs. And because of that, there's fewer verification tests that go on. It'll be more reliant on some self-reporting.
Well, our colleague at Bridge Magazine, Jonathan Osting, interviewed the majority leader in the Senate, Mike Shirky, and the senator has concerns about self-reporting assets and thinks that might lead to more fraud, or at least it could.
Yeah, and I actually asked the DHHS director, Robert Gordon, about that yesterday, sort of anticipating some of those concerns. He mentioned that the Office of Inspector General got a little bit of a funding boost in this year's budget, that they can do more to look at fraud, but he's not concerned that this particular policy will lead to an increase in fraud.
I recall that you mentioned the vehicle asset. I recall that Governor Snyder, under him, the head of the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services, Mara Corrigan, put a vehicle asset test in place because she saw an expensive car in the parking lot, which was owned by an aid recipient. What's become of that then? It's just gone?
Yeah, so that actually was rolled back under the Snyder administration as well. At first, they put that asset limit in place. And then, you know, that you have to remember that was 2011, slightly after the recession. There was a lot of people who, you know, may have had good jobs and bought expensive cars and lost their jobs and found themselves in a position of needing assistance. So, you know, that person with a Hummer could have a $0 income right now if they're not employed, or a much lower income. So the Snyder administration rolled it back so that you could have one car worth more than $15,000, but now there's no vehicle test at all. They mentioned specifically in some rural areas, there are families or recipients who need more than one car just to effectively get everyone to work and school.
Two quick questions. Do we know how many more people might be able to get benefits because of this change? And what's this going to cost the state?
I wish I had answers to those questions. Some of these programs are more federally supported than others. There are some state dollars that I believe go toward particular programs. But as of yesterday, the DHHS did not have any concrete numbers. You know, they are expecting an impact, but don't know what to expect at this point. And they expect the biggest impact to be on the food assistance program, which is federally funded.
Emily Lawler reports for MLive. Good to talk to you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Both chambers of the Michigan legislature have approved legislation that would mean no longer automatically treating 17-year-olds arrested for a crime as adults. Michigan is one of only four states in the nation to still do that. Here to talk about what that will mean if Governor Gretchen Whitmer signs it into law is Jason Smith. He's the Director of Youth Justice Policy for the Michigan Council on Crime and Delinquency. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Since by any other definition, 17 is not an adult, why has Michigan's justice system treated them as adults?
Our age of juvenile jurisdiction has been set at 17 since the establishment of the juvenile court. Every state, when they established their juvenile court, set their upper age of juvenile jurisdiction differently. Some states set the age at 16. And Michigan, back in 1912, when the juvenile court was established, set it at 17, when times were very different for a 17-year-old back then. Many of them were working, getting married, having children. And brain science and just the overall shift in society has shown that 17-year-olds are still kids and should be treated that way.
So let's talk about what has happened in the past. How are 17-year-olds treated when they're convicted and put into prison with adults?
So they're treated in the exact same way that the justice system treats a 30-year-old, 35-year-old. They're prosecuted, convicted, sentenced as adults, placed in the same facilities that adults are placed in over the age of 18, and they're given the same sanctions and treatment options that adults do. The problem is that a 17-year-old is still a child, as shown by every other aspect of society. Every other system or institution that serves young people treats 17-year-olds as kids. Schools, the child welfare system, we're talking about juniors and seniors in high school here. The treatment options available to them in the adult system does not reflect their status as youth. 17-year-olds are still very much dependent on their parents and family members for their health and well-being. They, again, touch several institutions that treat them as young people. The juvenile justice system has a better, stronger collaborative relationship with a lot of institutions that engage the entire family of that 17-year-old, not just the youth, whereas the adult system really treats any individual that's under their jurisdiction, be it in the some sort of confinement situation, adult prison or jail, or even on probation in the community, as a unique individual where they're solely responsible for getting to appointments, checking in with probation officers, paying fines and fees as if they're working and living on their own independently.
So this idea of raising the age to 18 has been around for a while. One of the concerns, though, is that instead of the state paying the cost of incarcerating a 17-year-old, since they will be treated as juveniles, that means different courts and the cost shifts to the counties. The bills that passed would have the state reimburse counties until 2025. What happens after that?
So the primary funding mechanism for juvenile justice services in the state is done under what's called the Child Care Fund, which is managed by the Department of Health and Human Services. So in general, young people under the age of 16, and I should say, too, that a 17-year-old can't currently be served in the juvenile justice system if they come into the system before they turn 17. So you're 16, adjudicated, placed on probation, and you have a birthday. The juvenile court continues to serve them, so it's not an entirely new population. The Child Care Fund allows for counties to be reimbursed for most expenditures that DHHS determines to be eligible for reimbursement. The counties pay for costs, and this is for community-based treatment and for out-of-home care for kids who require some need for out-of-home treatment. The counties pay for those services up front first, 100%, and then the state would reimburse them back at 50%.
So how much did that cost to counties weigh in Michigan waiting so long to seriously consider changing the law?
I think that one of the reasons that the delay has happened here is really there was so much focus on trying to figure out that exact number. How much would it actually cost? How many 17-year-olds would the juvenile court actually get and what that would translate to? And I think that all of the stakeholders involved, including the advocates, the counties, the lawmakers themselves at the state level, realize that some of this information you just won't get until you actually make that change and you implement the policy change and incorporate 17-year-olds into the juvenile system. Doing some sort of point-in-time estimate for what the cost would be is just not realistic. The caseloads in the juvenile justice system has continued to decline year after year. Michigan's an aging population. There are fewer youth getting arrested, and caseloads have declined. So even an estimate given at one point based on the number of 17-year-olds in the adult system won't necessarily translate to what it would be several years down the road. And currently, the legislation that's proposed has a two-year implementation date. So October 1st, 2021, we may have much less 17-year-olds than we even had in 2017 or 2018 when these estimates were developed. And I should say, other states that have done estimates on their raise the age have shown that once it was actually implemented, the fiscal analysis or the estimates given for how much it would cost the states have actually been lower than what actually happens.
As I understand it, prosecutors will still have the option of charging a 17-year-old as an adult. Is that something that could be abused?
Maybe. I hope not. It may be a situation where prosecutors waive more and then it evens out over time. It's hopefully will happen on a case-by-case basis, that where they're looking at the entirety of the case and the individual of the young person who's committed that offense. But that's an option politically to get raise the age passed has to exist, and it exists in almost every state that has passed raise the age legislation in the last decade. There is some sort of mechanism that allows young people who commit serious offenses to be treated as adults, prosecuted and convicted as adults.
Bottom line this for us, why do you think this is good for Michigan residents?
This is aligning our state with the best practices in how states treat young people who come into contact with the justice system. It aligns with all the other laws that govern our society and how you view someone under the age of 18. As you've stated, 17-year-olds cannot vote. They can't sign contracts. They can't enter leases. This aligns with how we treat young people in our state under every other circumstance. And it allows 17-year-olds to participate in treatment that's really designed to make sure that they are rehabilitated and not reoffend as in the future as adults. It has long-term benefits in reducing future crimes, future victimization costs. It gives young people under the age of 18, 17-year-olds specifically, the option to participate in treatment that's designed to their age and developmental status as young people.
Jason Smith is the Director of Youth Justice Policy for the Michigan Council on Crime and Delinquency. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you again for having me.
Coming up, the Pure Michigan Tourism Campaign has been incredibly popular, but has it been successful?
It invokes emotion. And when you look at tourism marketing, that's really what it's all about.
After the break, the politics of tourism. Stick around. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The Pure Michigan Tourism Campaign has been effective in that it improves the state's image and gives Michigan residents a sense of pride.
This is a postcard from Michigan, where wishing you were here is the heart of Pure Michigan.
It's been incredibly popular, but has it been successful? Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer used her line item veto authority to eliminate the $37.5 million approved by the legislature. She zeroed it out. The governor, who herself had proposed $31 million for Pure Michigan, says she's willing to negotiate with the Republican-led legislature. There are questions, though, about whether it makes sense to use tens of millions of taxpayer dollars to support one industry, tourism. And there are conflicting reports about what kind of return on investment Michigan gets for Pure Michigan. Here to talk about that is Evan Jordan. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Recreation, Park, and Tourism Studies at Indiana University. He's also a Michigan native from Pawpaw who was educated at Michigan State University. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
I read that Michigan has been spending close to twice the national average on tourism promotion. It has the fourth highest spending level in the nation, only with only California, Hawaii, and Florida spending more. But Michigan doesn't even crack the top 10 in tourism rates. In fact, a Business Insider ranking shows Michigan is at number 31 in the nation based on hotel bookings. So what does that all tell us?
Well, one of the things that that tells us is there's a lot of different ways to measure these things. As you mentioned, there's a lot of questions as to the impact of spending these $30 million on the Pure Michigan campaign. And there's a lot of different ways that people calculate that impact. But there's also a lot of different ways that people calculate the number of visitors that come to any given state. So in places like Hawaii, it's really easy to measure people coming in and out because everyone has to come either on a plane or on a boat, and you can essentially measure every single person that comes in. For states like Michigan, who the majority of visitors are going to be coming by car, it's really hard to estimate that. So if you look at something like hotel bookings, that doesn't necessarily tell you the full story. According to a study that Michigan MEDC commissioned by Tourism Economics, they estimated that in 2018, about 125 million people visited Michigan in 2018. So that is actually on par, if you look at those statistics, with a state like Florida, which had about 130 million visitors. So there's a lot of different ways of looking at that, and that's one of the points of contention, I think, with states like Michigan spending that much money on a tourism marketing campaign.
And the numbers from MEDC have been questioned by some, and some analysis by a think tank called the Mackinac Policy Center has also, you know, questioned whether they're measuring it correctly or who they're having measure it for them. So what's the best way to measure how successful Pure Michigan has been?
Well, there's a lot of different ways of looking at it. People tend to want to think about strictly economic impact. So how much money are we generating? How many more visitors are coming to the state based on this advertising campaign? But there's a lot of other things that go along with it. For instance, does it change the way that people view Michigan as a state? How does it affect Michigan's brand, which doesn't necessarily result in visitors coming necessarily this year or next year, but it could have people coming to the state 10 years from now because their perceptions of Michigan have changed for the positive. And that doesn't just affect tourism. That affects all sorts of other industries that may be located in Michigan as well. So, you know, I don't think there is really one best way of measuring the impacts of an advertising campaign because it is so complex and how it affects people psychologically as well as how it affects their behaviors.
Well, let's talk about the rates of return. The state of Michigan, the MEDC, has claimed something like close to $9 for every dollar spent on Pure Michigan. How likely is that?
Well, it's really hard to determine whether that is correct or not because the companies that have come up with these numbers don't always, or actually rarely, publish their research methodology. So it's hard for somebody like me, who especially as a not necessarily an economist, to know what did they include in that? What are they using as their multiplier in terms of economic impacts? So it's really hard for me to say, is $9 accurate or is $2 accurate? It's hard to say without looking at the numbers that whoever is calculating these things is using. But, you know, in reality, I'd say that estimate is $9. Some other estimates are essentially $0. The reality is it's probably somewhere in between those two things.
So just looking at it broadly, how successful is Pure Michigan, its tourism campaign, compared to other states' efforts?
Well, that really depends on who you ask. But in terms of broad public awareness and in terms of perceptions within the tourism industry and within particularly state tourism marketing campaigns, Pure Michigan is used as an exemplar of an excellent way of marketing a state. It's an example that I use in my own classroom. You know, maybe that's because I am a Michigander, and so I have a spot in my heart for Michigan. But if you look throughout the industry, almost everybody looks at the Pure Michigan campaign as a success in a lot of different ways.
Well, we also hear about other states and their campaigns. Who's doing it right in other states?
Sure. One example that I always like to use is Visit California. They have an advertisement that they put out a few years ago that included Betty White and Kim Kardashian and the Jonas Brothers.
Like how we all live in bikinis and act like rock stars.
You want to know the truth about California?
Get out here. We'll show you how we roll.
Sort of playing off of what people know about California in that there's a lot of famous people. They have Hollywood. But at the same time, they were also in the background showcasing that they have surf tourism, that they have forest, they have Muir Woods, that they have cultural attractions. I think they showed the LA Opera in that particular advertisement. So They've done a great job. Hawaii has done a really interesting campaign recently called Let Hawaii Happen.
We went to the island of Hawaii to look at the stars, hoping to make a big discovery.
Want
to
go check it out?
Did we make one?
Oh.
I'd say we made a few.
And their approach is essentially to let the state and cultural, natural resources kind of speak for themselves.
We were talking a little bit about those things you really cannot measure. The Pure Michigan campaign is very popular with the people in Michigan, is hopefully it is popular in the states where we're actually showing the ads too. And the tourism industry would rather have it than not. But how much does it benefit the state in those things we cannot measure?
Well, I think it goes a long way toward changing people's views towards the state. One of the things that I really like about the Pure Michigan campaign is that it invokes emotion. And when you look at tourism marketing, that's really what it's all about. Invoking emotion in people to get them to form that psychological connection with your tourism destination, wherever it may be. And the Pure Michigan campaign, one of the reasons it's received so many awards is because it does that. And it does that with a combination of imagery with the natural resources of Michigan, like Sleeping Bear Dunes and the Pictured Rocks. It does it with Tim Allen's voice, which a lot of people associate with a family-friendly atmosphere. If you think back to his show Home Improvement, a lot of people still have those perceptions of him. It does it with soft music in the background. And so in that way, I think eliciting emotions from people and changing the way that they feel about the state at a little bit deeper level than, am I just going to visit there? I think it's been incredibly successful.
Okay, well, that leads to the question, do you think Michigan needs the Pure Michigan Tourism Advertising Campaign? And if you were advising the legislature and the governor, what would you tell them?
Sure. I think it does. I think to remain competitive in terms of states within the United States, you need to have a tourism advertising budget. We've actually seen examples recently of places like Florida and Hawaii cutting their budget a little bit, which is kind of weird because those things tend to go with as the economy goes. So when the economy is going well, you're getting a lot of tax revenue. Funding for state tourism offices and advertising campaigns tends to go up. So right now, when we have had a fairly positive economy, it's kind of weird to see Florida and Hawaii reduce their budgets a little bit. They have actually had a couple of scandals that have caused them to reduce their budgets. But, you know, it's a competitive marketplace right now for travelers in the U.S. So I do think Pure Michigan should be funded. I think it's going to be funded. I think it'll probably be at a little bit lower rate than what was suggested, which was around $37 million. You know, I think $30 million for a state like Michigan that's getting around 125 million visitors a year is a pretty reasonable amount for a tourism marketing campaign.
Evan Jordan is an assistant professor at Indiana University in the Department of Recreation, Park, and Tourism Studies. He's also a Michigan native. Thanks for sharing with us.
Thank you, Lester.
Well, it's Friday. Time to check in with our Friday political commentators. Ken Sekema is a senior policy fellow for Public Sector Consultants. He's a former Republican majority leader of the Michigan Senate. T.J. Buchholz is president of Vanguard Public Affairs, a progressive political strategy firm. He worked for Governors Engler and Granholm and headed up communications for Lieutenant Governor John Cherry. Gentlemen, one of the state of Michigan budget line item vetoes by Governor Gretchen Whitmer was money for the Pure Michigan Tourism Campaign. Ken, why do you think the governor eliminated funding for Pure Michigan?
Oh, I just think it's part of the larger kind of budget negotiating position she's trying to establish. Although her original budget proposed a modest reduction in that program, my own opinion about the veto is I don't think she's particularly desirous of totally eliminating the Pure Michigan campaign.
So this is like a card in the hole then?
Well, I think so, but I mean, I'm kind of an outside observer here.
TJ, the governor had $31 million for Pure Michigan in her proposed budget. The legislature said, let's do it $37.5 million. Why do you think she eliminated all the funding?
I think it's a
political stratagem to some degree. You know, we want to have people at the table. Pure Michigan is popular with Republicans, especially those that, you know, their constituents have businesses up north and rely on the tourism industry to drive the economy there. I think there is, you know, quite a bit of data that tells us that Pure Michigan and the investment that the state makes is that there is a return on that investment, and that's important. You know, in the big scheme of things, when you look at a ad campaign like this one, and it's, you know, $37-38 million in total, it is a small campaign compared to some of the other larger campaigns you see from the auto industry to sell product. Again, this is you know, mostly public dollar, and it needs to be scrutinized. But I don't think anyone doubts that the Pure Michigan campaign has been successful to a large degree.
But there is the argument that taxpayer dollars should not be advertising for a single industry. Ken, what do you think of the government basically putting ads on television and in print around the nation to benefit the tourism industry?
Well, it's just a subset of the larger debate about, you know, should a state have various kinds of incentive programs to attract business and industry? It's not just by itself in terms of that debate. You also have these large packages that are designed to attract an Amazon or a big manufacturing outfit to the state. So that's all part of the same argument. And I don't think you could just isolate something like Pure Michigan just because it's advertising that's designed to help the tourism industry. Like a tax cut package would be designed to bring Amazon. I mean, it's all part and parcel of the same debate.
TJ, you said it's a relatively small amount. However, Michigan spends a lot more than the national average. And, you know, it doesn't even crack the top 10 for tourism, even though they're number four for spending on tourism campaigns. So what do you think of that argument? Are we really getting our bang for the buck?
Well, I think there's been a lot of study from different companies that the state has contracted to see what that return on investment is. How much money does the tourism industry sort of get from the investment that the state makes? And, you know, I think that you are seeing, you know, a multiple time investment, multiple times, you know, the ROI, and that's important. And the thing is, you know, let me stop you there.
By whose measure? Because we've seen those numbers from the MEDC, and they're you know, saying as much as $9 on every dollar spent. But those analyses have been questioned by a number of people. Do you trust those numbers?
Well, I think sometimes that criticism, again, is politically motivated in terms of should we spend $35 million or whatever we spend it right now another way. But I don't think that, you know, the state designed a plan to assess this program. If they've used different firms over the years to sort of evaluate that investment. And I think by and large, they do see that there is an important return on our investment. Again, you see more Pure Michigan ads when you travel out of the state, when you go to the West Coast or where you go down south, even when you go into Europe. And the goal is to bring more people to Michigan, more people to partake of what we have here. And, you know, the tourism industry, because of the weather, only goes so long in this state, especially as you look up north. So I don't think that there's any question in most people's minds that there is a return on investment that's important here.
So what's going to happen with all of this? Are we going to see some kind of compromise soon, or is this going to be that chip in the deal that is reserved? Ken?
Well, I don't think I don't think you want to go completely dark vis-a-vis other states in terms of trying to attract tourists. So I think at some point there'll be a, you know, replacement for this, and there'll be money for it. There'll be a Pure Michigan campaign now, sooner or later. I tell you, my crystal ball there is pretty murky.
Okay, TJ, same question. What's going to happen?
I don't think, you know, Pure Michigan has been a campaign that's been embraced by both sides of the aisle. You know, Governor Granholm, you know, back in the day, you know, really lobbied the legislature hard for more dollar to go into it. Governor Snyder believed the program had a lot of merit. So I think you'll see some sort of supplemental, you know, before maybe even the end of the year. To correct this. And again, it's, you know, they're only a few million dollars apart. I think both sides see the real value of the campaign.
You know, I'm curious what you guys think about this. You see Illinois' campaign, you see Ohio's campaign, for example, and people go, that's nice. But Michiganders seem to really love this Pure Michigan campaign. Why do you think that citizens in the state embrace it so much?
Well, I just think it is resonated and struck a chord over time. I don't want to necessarily use the word clever. I don't mean to diminish it by using the word clever, but it's a clever and a good campaign. I think there are competing studies in terms of, is there a return on investment? I'm not sure you'll ever kind of come to a definitive conclusion about that, but it is, frankly, pretty popular.
Why is it so beloved, TJ?
Well, I think people get to see so much of this state in these ads, and they are beautifully done, obviously. They're really well thought out, really well shot. And you get to see and really kind of understand what a lot of Michiganders who've been in different parts of the state, as I know both of you have as well, is, you know, that we have so much hidden beauty here, so many treasures. And, you know, I think that we want people to see our state. We want people to understand the same sort of magnitude of beauty in Michigan that we do. And for me, it's just it makes me feel good as a Michigan citizen. I'm sure that's true for tens of thousands of other people as well.
TJ Buchholz is president of Vanguard Public Affairs, a progressive political strategy firm. He worked for Governors Engler and Granholm and headed up communications for Lieutenant Governor John Cherry. Ken Sikkema is senior policy fellow for Public Sector Consultants. He's a former Republican majority leader of the Michigan Senate. Thanks very much, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lester.
Have a great weekend. Still to come, a butterfly once common in the Great Lakes region is now critically endangered.
Now is the time. If we don't act quickly, this butterfly will be lost.
The telling tale of the butterfly known as the Poweshiek Skipperling. That's in about 10 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The state of Michigan is looking into how counties handle jailing suspects and those serving short sentences. But at the same time, some counties are doing their own studies. Wayne County held a meeting last night to learn about a study into how to reduce the number of people incarcerated. Joining us now are two guests with a stake in the issue. Robert Dunlap is the chief of jails for the Wayne County Sheriff's Office. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Timothy Kenny is Chief Judge of the Wayne County Circuit Court. Judge, thanks for taking the time.
Good morning. My pleasure.
Let's first talk about why this issue now. I mean, Wayne County is building a new jail. It will have fewer beds, I understand, than the current jail. How much of that is a factor in studying the issue at this time?
Well, I think from the court's perspective, there was an opportunity that was presented to us to take a look at exactly who is in our jail, how long are they staying, and are there ways that can reduce the jail population. And that would be especially helpful as we get ready to transition into a new jail facility 3 years from now.
Chief Dunlap, on average, how many people are in the Wayne County Jail on a given day?
Well, currently we're averaging right at 1,620 people over the last month.
How does that compare historically?
So that's significantly down. About 4 years ago, we were trending right at 2,250, 2,400 people. And so over the last year and a half, we have been trending down. And our number today actually is 1,621 in the jail with another 614 out on electronic monitoring.
On tethers, okay. I want both of you to answer this question. Judge, we'll start with you. Do they all need to be there to keep the public safe?
Well, I think the answer to that is no, but it is something that we're grateful to have the data analysis that the Vera Institute out of New York is compiling for us so that we can do sort of a deep dive into exactly who is in the jail and are there options for us to implement that will enable us to not have people go into the jail at all, but also make sure that they're going to show up for their court appearances and also not pose a risk to public safety.
Chief, do they all need to be there to keep the public safe?
Well, I will respond to you the way that Sheriff Napoleon has said to many as he traveled throughout Wayne County and across the country. The jail should be for people that are dangerous to the community and the people, not for people that we are mad at or people that are ill. So the answer is no.
What did the study that was revealed last night show, or what kind of direction will it give Wayne County in reducing the number of people it holds in jail?
Well, the information and data that was shared with us last night is preliminary data, and the final report from the Vera Institute won't come in until January. But there were a number of very interesting findings. Of those who are in the Wayne County Jail, the biggest single segment of individuals appears to be those who come in on traffic-related matters. It really poses, I think, sort of an interesting intersection, if you will, particularly for Detroiters, of the high cost of automobile insurance, employment, and the necessity to drive. Because what we see frequently, and the chief may confirm this, you have people who end up getting a traffic violation, maybe a speeding ticket, and they have to go to work, but they're paying such exorbitant automobile insurance that they can't afford to pay the speeding ticket, and so they don't show up to court and they don't pay the ticket, and so there's a bench warrant for their arrest that's put out. So then maybe 2-3 months later they get picked up, you know, on another traffic violation, maybe a bad taillight or something, and they end up in the Wayne County Jail because there's a bench warrant for their arrest on a traffic matter. And that's something that we really need to take a look at. You have people who can't afford to pay the ticket, but they've still got to go to work, and the only way they can get to work is to drive.
Well, Judge Kenny, I know that there are other people who don't show up for their court dates and they end up being jailed. What can you do about that?
Well, I think that it all depends on what the reason is for their not appearing. Sometimes people don't appear in court and they have a good reason. They may have been hospitalized, or they may have been locked up in another jurisdiction or something like that. But I think that our use of tether has been effective. But I think your point, or your question rather, also I think pushes us toward the notion of courts may need to go more to the notion of sending out text and voicemail reminders like you do when you have a dental appointment or a doctor appointment. That has been effective in other jurisdictions.
Chief Dunlap, I read that a lot of people with mental health issues are housed in the jail. Why does that happen, and what can be done about that?
Well, unfortunately, right now in the Wayne County jails, we are probably the largest inpatient mental health facility in the state of Michigan. And I say that because we set aside 120 beds for people who are seriously mentally ill. And on any given day, we have approximately 90 of those beds filled. And these are individuals who are under doctor supervision and on medication. And you ask the question, why does that happen? I think it's a buildup over time of multiple economic and social issues that lead to mental health issues that, if not properly addressed, cause these individuals to recidivate back and forth into the criminal justice system.
Yeah, this sounds like a failure in dealing with mental health issues and funding that rather than a jail problem.
I agree. One of the things that we're doing in Wayne County, as you know, Judge Kenny indicated about the use of tether, we have seen quite a few people who have been arrested on misdemeanor-type charges that also have connections to the Detroit Wayne Mental Health Authority, in that they are registered consumers with the authority. At one point in time, we took a look at the data, and approximately 80% of the people that were booked in on misdemeanor charges alone all have connections with the Detroit Wayne Mental Health Authority.
We're running out of time here, but I want to ask you both, you've had a chance to hear about this data, this study. What's the next step? Judge, let's start with you.
Well, the preliminary data that we received last night, as I'm sure you can imagine, it's like peeling an onion. It certainly reveals other layers of inquiry where we are going to have additional questions, and we're looking to the Vera Institute to refine the data a little more for us. As I indicated, I think we're going to get their report in January. We are going to then have the Vera Institute folks come in and meet with all of the stakeholders that have been involved thus far and exchange questions and information at that point. And then we'll put together a plan of action. I anticipate that certainly 2020 is going to be an opportunity for change in terms of how we do the entire issue of pretrial release.
Chief, what are you looking for next?
So what I'm looking for next is the continued momentum. I'm excited about what the VIRA project has done. It has, in my opinion, highlighted some of the good things that have already been taking place in Wayne County and exposed the different areas that we could work to continue the improvements that's taken place. And I'm really looking forward to the collaboration of all the stakeholders getting to the table, continuing the success that we have had in reducing our jail population. As I indicated, just 4 years ago, 2,250 people. Today, right at 1,650 people. And what that tells me is I think folks are seeing that we need to make sure that we have the right people in the jails, and those people that shouldn't be in jails should be connected to treatment and employment.
Robert Dunlap is Chief of Jails for the Wayne County Sheriff's Office. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Timothy Kenney is Chief Judge of the Wayne County Circuit Court. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you.
Just since the 1990s, a certain type of butterfly has gone from an abundant population to a survey count of fewer than 100 in the U.S. and Canada. Of that number, 43 were found in Michigan, and most of those were in one spot in Oakland County. We learned all that from the Detroit Free Press reporter Keith Matheny's recent story on the Poweshiek skipperling butterfly. Here to tell us more about that butterfly is Nick Haddad. He's a professor and senior terrestrial ecologist at the Department of Integrated Biology at Michigan State University. He's based at the W.K. Kellogg Biological Station near Battle Creek. So what does the Poweshiek skipperling butterfly look like?
So the Poweshiek skipperling is a very small orange butterfly. And so, yeah, it's not really remarkable, and it's hard to see. It's part of a group of butterflies that people often don't notice as being butterflies. They're so small and unapparent.
Yeah, and in the article that Matheny wrote, he was talking about there were so many of them, most of you guys didn't really pay that much attention to them. They were usually in the way of counting other butterflies.
Now, this is frightening. This butterfly once existed from Manitoba and then in an arc down Minnesota through Iowa, Wisconsin, and to Michigan. And now it's just in five places, and four of them are in Michigan.
So what caused the Poweshiek skipperling to go from this large population in the 1990s to critically endangered now?
Well, that's the mystery. I mean, we know one thing that's happened. Its habitat has been lost. But even then, it's declined still further.
What kind of habitat does it like?
So it lived in grasslands, like we call it tall grass prairie. But in Michigan, it lives in a grassy habitat that's also wet. It's called a fen.
So why do we have this small remnant population in Oakland County? What makes it special? Is it a fen?
Well, most of the area is in agricultural habitat, and that's been hit hard. In Michigan, it's in wet places, the places least struck by agriculture.
So they haven't been drained as a swamp or something like that over the centuries?
Or been plowed over. And it's also far from where people would apply pesticides and herbicides, and that's what we think is the big cause of recent decline.
Wow. We had pesticides before the 1990s, though. What's changed?
Well, there's this special class of pesticides called neonicotinoids. Mm-hmm. And they're a really intense class, and we worry that they're having a big impact on the butterflies.
That's the same pesticides that people believe is affecting honeybees, right?
Well, honeybees and lots of other insects.
How can the Powashik skipperling be saved?
Let me tell you, if you could see it now, this is the time, because it may be lost. I mean, I got to see it 2 years ago, and I'm thankful that I did. You know, it's just right on the edge of extinction. And so how can we save it? Well, people in Michigan are, you know, really trying to do the habitat conservation for the butterfly. But there's other ways, too. So people here have been trying to catch caterpillars and bring them into greenhouses and raise them. Then we can propagate them and increase numbers and hopefully release them into places that are good habitat or restored habitat and expand their populations once again. But, you know, now is the time. If we don't act quickly, this butterfly will be lost.
We just learned about the Powashik skipperling. What kinds of other butterflies and pollinators are facing similar challenges that we might not know about?
Well, that's the problem. I mean, you know, we worry about Powashik skipperling decline, and, you know, we're seeing it right now, but other insects are declining as well. And, you know, we know the most about declines of the butterflies because we follow the butterflies most closely. And we know that, you know, butterflies in general are declining by something like 2% per year in abundance. So we've done work in Ohio, so states nearby, and found that the number of butterflies has declined by on the order of 30% in the last 2 decades. And so my neighbors often ask, you know, I haven't seen so many butterflies this year. Do you know if something's happening? Do scientists think this? And in the past, I used to nod my head and say, well, maybe it was just a bad year or whatever. And now I know from the data that have come in that the decline is happening. And so what really worries me about Powashik skipperling is that we know it's on the verge of extinction, but it is representative of other insects, other butterflies, other insects, other pollinators that are also facing the same kinds of declines. We don't necessarily know as much about them, but frankly, watching the Powashik on the verge of extinction, well, other butterflies, other insects could follow soon behind.
I reported earlier this year about a survey showing some of the bumblebee populations in Michigan are dropping significantly, some by half, and people were really, really surprised. Why do you think these dramatic drops in pollinator populations are not better known?
So the reason we know most about the butterflies is that people know butterflies the best. And so we can go out, not just me, scientists, but also people that love butterflies and are knowledgeable about them. We can go out and count them and know about them. The bees, they're another story. So we know a lot, of course, about honeybee declines, and then we can learn about declines of things like bumblebees that we can easily see, recognize, and count. But many of the bees are tiny, and so I have students in my lab that spend days and days sorting through samples of the other bees. It's not something that, you know, the average person or the average scientist can go out and do easily.
What can people do at home to help butterflies like this and other pollinators survive?
At home, there's really just a few things that people can do. One is get out there and just plant plants in their yards, in their gardens to encourage butterflies, pollinators, and this would include planting flowering plants or food plants for butterflies. Like I go out in my own yard and plant milkweed. And if we each just took a little bit of our yard and made it into habitat, well, guess what? That adds up and makes it a better place for the insects in general. And the other thing I like to encourage people is to just get to know the butterflies. I mean, we all know about monarchs and we all don't know about the Powashik skipperling, but they're a group that we can pick up a field guide and learn more about them. I mean, in my view, butterflies are the new birds. They're the thing out to get out there and really understand and learn more about nature.
Nick Haddad is a professor and senior terrestrial ecologist at Michigan State University. We've been talking about how the Powashik skipperling butterfly has so quickly become critically endangered. Thanks for telling us about this.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Next week on Stateside, we talk to the Wall Street Journal reporter who investigated the death of a young Michigan man and FBI informant who went missing in Ukraine.
He had some language skills. He had taught himself to some degree Arabic and Russian. But in addition, he had a great interest in global conflict.
Plus, we'll look at the impact the Canadian elections might have on Michigan and talk to a hemp farmer about the state's first harvest. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.